The Office of the State Historian is proud to present the New Mexico Digital History Project podcast series.
Thank you. I'd like to thank you all for attending today's presentation. I'd also like to thank the Office of the State Historian, Dr. Trujillo, the State Archives staff, especially Samuel Cisneros, Professor Blumenfeld, who has supported this project from the beginning, Ernesto Longa, and Professor Parker at the University Law Library. Today's presentation will focus on Governor Tomas Velez Cachupin and the grants to the Pueblos of Zia, Jemez, Santa Ana, and Cochiti. First, I'd like to briefly state how I became interested in this topic. In the process of completing my writing requirement on the legal history of land disputes in the colonial and territorial period, I identified the 1766 Ojo del Espíritu Santo grant as a conveyance that deserved a more detailed study. It had been a claim first approved by the Surveyor General, but it was ultimately denied by the Court of Private Land Claims, whose decision the U.S. Supreme Court affirmed in Pueblo of Zia versus the United States. While doing that research, I compared this grant to the Sandia grant of 1748, highlighting the similarities in the acts of possession and suggested that the Court of Private Land Claims wrongly decided the case. However, I knew that I needed to study the grant in more detail, and I wanted to study it in its historical context. The first step was to perform a diplomatic study of the actual document. Diplomatics is a subdiscipline of history and law, and the purpose is to establish as unequivocally as possible just what a document is and what precisely it says. In the process, I proceeded in other directions as well, and I realized that these grants that we're going to examine today are very unique, and that really there are only 18 documents, grant documents, that the Spanish governors issued to particular pueblos. But 14 of these, at some point in history, were declared spurious or forgeries. And 13 of them today are generally considered spurious, and those are known as the Cruzate grants. And we'll look at those in detail a little bit later. But I identified five grants to the pueblos that are generally considered legitimate, and I'd like to name those. The Sandia Pueblo grant of 1748, the Cañada de Santa Clara grant, the Cochiti Pueblo Pasture Grant, the Testimonio of the Ojo del Espíritu Santo Grant, and the Santo Domingo and San Felipe Pasture Grant. Those five are, I consider those five to be a different class of grants than the Cruzate grants. The Cruzate grants are one group, and I'll talk more about the problems with those grants, and then we'll look at these other two grants. So the focus on the two grants today will be on the Testimonio of the Ojo del Espíritu Santo and the Testimonio of the Cochiti Pueblo Pasture Grant. And when I say testimonio, what I mean by that is the certified copy of the original grant documents. In a Spanish grant, there would be a petition, there would be a commission to go and examine the lands requested for, there would be a granting decree, there would be a report by the alcalde, and there would be an act of possession. So the testimonio is a copy of all of these documents, and that document, the testimonio, is issued to the grantees. So the pueblos would have, when they received these grants, they would have received the testimonio. Also, alcalde mayor, that would be the official, it loosely translates to chief justice or high official, and his duties were not only judicial, but were also, if his jurisdiction was attacked, he would lead the militia to defend the jurisdiction. So his duties were a little bit more comprehensive than just a judge. So those are terms that I might use today. And then we'll also talk about Tomas Velez Cachupin, who served two terms, and they weren't consecutive terms because he was supposed to have a consecutive term, but by the time he received the message, he had already left New Mexico, so he was given a second term in 1762. The overall objectives of this particular study are to establish the authenticity of the grants and to evaluate the claims within them. And to do this, I proceeded one step at a time, and the first step was to establish the authenticity of the grants. And in doing so, I felt it was important to distinguish these grants that we're going to look at, the Ojo del Espíritu Santo grant and the Coche de Pueblo grant, from the Cruzate grants. I felt that that was important. I also wanted to establish that these grants were, in fact, drafted in the colonial period. They weren't drafted later, but they were drafted in the period consistent with when we should find them. And I also wanted to discover who did draft the Ojo del Espíritu Santo grant. Who is the official who wrote it? And I looked at, was it Tomás Vélez Cachupín? Was it another official that's on the document? Was it one of the witnesses? Was it Felipe Tafoya, who represented all four of these pueblos? Who was it? So in the process, I wanted to identify that, because if you can identify the handwriting, then you can more firmly place the document in a specific time period. So once that was established, I wanted to move on and evaluate the claims within the grant. And I'll talk a little bit more about this, but there's what I would consider an aboriginal claim, a claim to lands that the pueblos considered theirs as far back as they can remember. I also wanted to answer the question, under Spanish law, could an aboriginal claim be acknowledged? And also, if it could be acknowledged under Spanish law, would Tomás Vélez Cachupín acknowledge it? Was he the type of governor who would know the law and, in fact, acknowledge it? So those were the objectives that I set out to do. And the first thing I want to do is just do a little bit of background on the Cruzate grants. This is the Cruzate grant from the Santo Domingo Pueblo file in the Surveyor General's office. In the Spanish Archives of New Mexico Surveyor General's files. A little background on the Cruzate grants. The Cruzate grants were allegedly issued in 1689 during the Pueblo Revolt by Governor Domingo Herranza Patriz de Cruzate. He supposedly issued them to all of the existing pueblos at the time. When the United States took over New Mexico, the Surveyor General attempted to confirm land grants and title to New Mexico residents in accordance with the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. Shortly after this is when these Cruzate grants, first appeared. So accordingly, the most likely theory for their creation is that the pueblos were told that they would need some sort of paper title to show to the Surveyor General. And what likely happened is that someone or some group created the Cruzate grants and sold them or attempted to sell them to the pueblos. Eventually, 11 pueblos submitted a Cruzate grant to the Surveyor General, and Congress confirmed all of them. In the late 1800s, however, their authenticity was questioned by an agent of the Court of Private Land Claims. And in fact, there's several problems to the Cruzate grants, and that's why I want to say that there's two groups of documents. There's these Cruzate grants, but then I'm going to argue that there's this group of legitimate grants from the Spanish governors to the pueblos. And I'd like to go over a few things on these Cruzate grants. On the top is the known valid signature of Domingo Herranza Patriz de Cruzate. Below it is a signature on one of the Cruzate grants. And as you can see, the big rubric on the left is supposed to be a D. And if you look at the bottom one, you can see the hesitations. All those hesitations today, like when experts examine an autographed baseball, when they see hesitations, they know that there's something wrong with that signature. But you can see there's something very wrong with that signature because it doesn't match. Also, if you follow, just a second. Right here, this is the name Patrice. That's an E on the Cruzate grants, but here's, if you look to the top, the second letter, it's like a C. That's how the real Domingo Herranza Patriz de Cruzate signed his name. His E was like a C, but when they did these, but when this grant was made, they did that. Also, the J is different, the G is different, the D is different. And the E here at the end, the little rubric or signature mark, is also different. So you can see this signature is very different. Of course, there's more problems, and one of the problems is that all the signatures on the Cruzate grants are in the same handwriting. So that's another problem. The watermarks. The paper used in the Cruzate grants has watermarks that it's known to be from 1832 to 1869. Mariano is the name that's here, that you can see up here. And this paper manufacturer is known to have made this paper in the 1830s to 1869. And these grants allegedly are from 1689. Over here is a scripted M. So that's another problem with these grants. There's also some anachronisms, such as phrases from books from the 1830s that show up in the grants. So there's a lot of problems. So when I was doing this research, I felt it was very important, if you're going to authenticate these grants, to distinguish them from the Cruzate grants. So that was one reason. Another reason was these two grants we're going to look at don't have signatures on them. So that there's a problem there in that you can't authenticate the signatures. Some of the other grants that I mentioned earlier, such as the Cañada de Santa Clara grant, that has signatures from three different governors because the controversy over the land spanned several decades. So there's three actual signatures, Tomás Vélez Cachupín, Juan Bautista de Anza, and Fernanda de la Concha. All three of those governors, you can see their signatures and compare them to known good signatures. So these grants don't have any signatures. So, but there's other ways. But a testimonial wouldn't necessarily have a signature, and there's actually a reason why this testimonial doesn't have a signature, and I'll get to that later. But just because there's no signature doesn't mean that it's not valid. A lot of testimonials didn't have signatures. Another reason to examine these is that the Court of Private Land Claims said that they were grazing permits. And I'll go over the grant and I'll show how that can't be. And this grant that we're looking at here, this is page 4. This is page 4 of the Ojo del Espíritu Santo, the second leaf. This is the actual grant. And at one point, when this grant was before the Court of Private Land Claims, Thomas B. Catron claimed that it was a forgery. So that's another reason to do a detailed study of it. And a final reason is that the Cochiti Pueblo grant was rejected simply on the fact that this grant was rejected. It was never really adjudicated. They just said, look, this is so similar to the Ojo del Espíritu Santo grant, that was rejected, that we're just going to reject yours, and there's no reason really to get into it. One of the first things that I was able to discover and was sort of somewhat of a breakthrough was I found out who had drafted this grant. At first, I had gone through the governor, Tomás Vélez Cachupín. I'd gone through all the officials in the grant, Felipe Tafoya, Bartolomé Fernández, and I tried to match the handwriting. And I had a lot of trouble, and I kept wanting it to be Tomás Vélez Cachupín because that would make the most sense, that the governor did it. But as I was transcribing the Ojo del Espíritu Santo grant, I became so familiar with his handwriting that I started looking through the Spanish archives of New Mexico, and I just started looking at documents from this period. And I came across this document up here, and I immediately recognized this handwriting. If you could see original, if you look at the G and the G down here, the little the tilde above the O, consu, concuerda, the D, the way the D dips, the way the R's all look like X's. And there were several other words, the A's, some of the abbreviations.
James?
Yes?
I don't mean to break your stride here, but could you talk to us about how you came by your knowledge of handwriting, etc.?
Well, the way I learned about the handwriting of this is the handwriting of Antonio de Armenta, who was an alcalde mayor, who directly followed Bartolomé Fernández, and that's who you would expect to find making the testimony, the alcalde who followed the previous alcalde. And really, my knowledge of it came by studying this handwriting. You know, and I I looked into, I studied the letters in Spanish paleography books. Here, Zimmerman has a couple. And the Center for Southwest Research has a text on abbreviations. And I also, previous knowledge, I took a paleography class with Dr. Greenleaf about 10 years ago. So I used that knowledge, but it was because of doing the transcription of the grant, the four pages, I just became so familiar, and I tried to compare. I tried to, the letters that I tried to match were the D's, and at one point I thought, this must be Tomas Velas Cachupin, but I kept having problems with the capitals. But it was confusing because they used, in some places, they had two different capitals, V's, or they had different ways of. They had more than one version of a letter. But it was really by just transcribing it that I was able to just immediately recognize that this was the same person. And then I started comparing the capitals. He has a different capital V, but here you see the V in Villa. He has another one. But I could just tell. And so I thought, I'm going to go look at that particular document, and it's going to have, the same characteristics as the other one. So this was sort of the first breakthrough, and I was able to find out Antonio de Armenta served as alcalde mayor at least from the 1772 to 1805, and we know that he resigned in 1805 over a dispute with the governor, and we have that in the archives, so we have a firm end date, so that sometime between 1772 and 1805, he drafted the Testimonio of the Ojo del Espíritu Santo. Next, I looked at the watermark, and I immediately wanted to compare the watermark in the documents of the Ojo del Espíritu Santo and the testimonio from a land transaction that Antonio de Armenta signed. And I didn't find that they matched, but I did find in the Ojo, it had a bull like this. But as I started to look at catalogs of watermarks, I found that there was a lot of bulls. In fact, in the Mexico's General Archive, there's 36 different bulls. This particular bull was the papermaker was Gambino, Giacomo Gambino, and he made a watermark at that time. And like I said, I started to find that there was a lot of watermarks of a bull, and I wasn't really finding an exact match. I don't know if you can see. If you can see here, this bull is in a very similar stance with this one, but the face is a little bit different. And I thought that, well, maybe a watermark is a little wire design that's attached to a screen. And I thought maybe it got bent here, and that's why it looked different than the face here. Or maybe when they made this copy and published the book, the proportions changed a little bit. But when we made the picture of, this is page 4 of the Ojo del Espíritu Santo, leaf 2, when we made this image, we found this name down here, Notaro. And I found that in the archives in Mexico, there were there was at least one Notaro watermark from the 1770s and 1780s. But I also found that there were so many bulls, and I'll give you another example. There were so many bulls that matching that particular one would be difficult, even though we had the name, unless you found the name. But even this Cortino here, I found in the Santa Fe archives a bull with Cortino, but the lettering was different. But it had this knight or picador. This is some people refer to this as the bullfight. And I found two examples similar to this, but it just seemed like I wasn't going to find the exact bull. So I looked at the other page, and on the other page, there was this design, and this design was a little bit more unique. And this is on the first leaf. And in fact, when I first looked at this actual document, this design was so difficult to make out that I just said we have to work on the bull, because this is so. With the writing on both sides of the text, I couldn't sketch this out, and I couldn't see this. But when we made the picture, I was able to take a negative, and I traced this. And I also found that there was two examples of a Costa watermark in Mexico's archives. And I found this one. And I found this one, and I thought, like, I thought I had found the exact one, and I have. It is very similar, but I found two things. This circle and this little star are different. There's seven petals on this flower. There's six here. And the design is just, it may be that this was traced and this was traced, and in the tracing, some of the proportions went off. But I also came up with some other theories to explain this. And I mean, one is that the making the images, scanning them, copying them, the paper is in poor condition, the Ojo del Espíritu Santo grant is coming apart, and that could be it. But I also thought, and I also found out that there were paper makers who used two designs that were almost exactly the same. And what the paper maker did was he had screen A, screen B. So what he did was he was producing paper off two screens at the same time, but they looked almost exactly the same, but the mark might be a little bit off, or it might be a little bit different. The other theory I have is that this is the same screen, but this may be an earlier version of this or vice versa, and that at some point the screen was repaired and this is how it was repaired, and that these may only be 1 or 2 years apart. But what I did find is that this watermark is from 1785. And I know that Costa, through other examples in the archives, Costa had a completely different watermark in 1780. And I found that through comparing the changes in watermarks, many paper makers did so every 5 years or so. They would change their watermark. So I think that these two watermarks, if they're not the same screen, they're very close, a year or two, maybe 4 years at the most. And I found that 1786 was where I would, if I was going to say that testimonial was drafted in a particular year, I would say 1786, because about that time, there was the town of San Isidro who was petitioning for a grant in 1786. And that's right in between the Pueblos of Jimenez and the Pueblos of Zia. So that's probably when they would ask for a copy or another testimonial, because that would be, you know, they want to make sure that these new grants don't overlap their grant. So I thought that would be the most likely period. And at that time, Antonio de Armenta was also the alcalde mayor, so he would have made it. And he was also the recipient of the grant. He was one of the recipients of the San Isidro grant. And in 1788, the Cañon de San Diego grant was issued, and that also borders the Ojo del Espíritu Santo. So if I was going to say that it was copied in a particular date, I would probably say around 1786. That would probably be when it was. And this watermark on the left is from 1785. And the one on the right, I think, is so similar that it must either be a version that was used very close to the same date, or particular, or maybe a slightly different version used at the same time. Okay, before we go on to the claims within the grant, I wanted to say something about the Coche de Pueblo grant. Now, these grants that we're talking about, they were grants for the Pueblo village had already had their grant. These were grants for additional pasture lands. And the Ojo del Espíritu Santo, depending how you read the boundary calls, that was for 500,000 acres. So these were huge grants. The Coche de Pueblo grant was much smaller. But one of the problems I encountered with that is that all we have of that grant in the archives is a transcription. So I started working with the transcription, and I started looking at the abbreviations. And I found that the first 10 abbreviations in this transcription are all found exactly, abbreviated exactly the same way in the Ojo del Espíritu Santo. The phrasing in the grant, there's some similar phrases that Felipe Tafoya used, because he wrote the petition in both grants, and they're in both grants. The way it's so closely, in fact, that the Court of Private Land Claims thought that they were almost the exact thing. So when they rejected the Ojo, they rejected the Coche de Pueblo grant as well. But now I think that because they are so similar and they have the first 10 abbreviations are in both grants, that the Cochiti Pueblo grant is a transcription of an original testimony, an authentic testimonial, and that the Ojo del Espíritu Santo is an authentic testimonial, probably from the mid-1780s, and the Cochiti, even though we don't have the actual documents, probably is as well. But obviously, because it is a transcription, we're on less firm ground. But if we can accept the authenticity of those grants, we should look at what they say, and there's more to them that is unique than just what we've covered so far. And one of those is this claim right here. Que estos desde su fundación han reconocido por sus ejidos en las inmediaciones de dichos sus pueblos un valle que comúnmente llamar el Ojo del Espíritu Santo. That these pueblos from their foundation have considered as their common pasture lands in the near vicinities of the said pueblos a valley commonly called the Ojo del Espíritu Santo. So their claim is, the claim that they're making isn't that give us this land because we need it for these other things. They're saying, we claim this land because this we've considered this from the foundations of our pueblos. And the Cochiti Pueblo has the same exact claim. So what do I mean by an aboriginal claim? I mean, that's really it. It's very, you know, very straightforward, that the pueblos exercised control, authority, sovereignty over that territory, and that now that they're claiming that territory. So with that, I wanted to look at, but was it in the mindset of the Spanish government to acknowledge a claim like that? Was it there for them to accept that? I went back all the way to Isabel of Castile, Isabella Católica, and I looked at the codicil to her will, and I knew that from previous studies that she had become very upset over what some of the reports she was getting from the New World. And she said that she described the principal mission of Spain in the New World, Castile at that point, to spread the Catholic faith. But she also said that that her heirs needed to ensure that the indigenous did not receive any harm to their persons or their properties, and that they be well and justly treated. And then I looked into the writings of Franciscus de Vitoria, and he had also said that the indigenous had dominion over their property and exercised sovereignty. He stated that the indigenous populations were true owners of their land. Because I wanted to see, was it in the laws? I knew that the Recopilación, which was a compilation of Spanish laws from 1492 to 1681, I knew that was in there, but I wanted to see where it was rooted, and I wanted to trace it back and see how far I could trace it back. And I think that those principles were there, and that the Recopilación reflects that. And I found in the Recopilación, Book 4, Title 12, Law 18, which states that Indians should retain possession of the full amounts of their lands belonging to them either singularly or in communities, along with the water rights and irrigation works. Other laws stated that the indigenous populations were entitled to the lands that they possessed and that these lands could not be taken away. Additionally, they were entitled to the lands that they had held before the arrival of the Europeans. So I saw that the laws were there, but did Tomás Vélez Cachupín, was he someone who would recognize that? Was he someone who knew the Recopilación? I started looking again at the land grants and the decisions that he made in land controversies, and I found that in the Cañada de Santa Clara grant, he did in fact cite the Recopilación, and Juan Bautista de Anza, when he affirmed Vélez Cachupín's decision, he also cited the Recopilación. And then even in the grant to the town of the village of Abiquiú, Vélez Cachupín cited the Recopilación. And in fact, if you've read any of the works of Malcolm E. Bright, you'll see that Tomás Vélez Cachupín had the reputation of not only knowing the Recopilación, but knowing it verbatim. So in fact, he did. They made the claim, and my theory is that they knew that his term for governor would be up the following year, and that they needed to make the claim when they did, and that's why they made it. So I'd like to go over some of the things that this project has uncovered. One, the identification of Antonio de Armenta as the hand that drafted the testimonial of the Ojo del Espíritu Santo. dated the testimonio to the 1780s, probably 1786, by identifying the Costa watermark. Compiled evidence, the testimonio of the Cochiti Pueblo grant is an authentic grant. Evaluated Aboriginal claims as unique claims that the Spanish Crown recognized. Identified the surviving grant documents from the Spanish Crown to the New Mexico Pueblos and distinguished one group from the Cruzate grants, and that group is a collection of authentic grants. If you have any questions, I'll take questions. I think there's so many different directions to go in. I want to look more at the Cochiti Pueblo grant. I want to study more the laws of the Recopilación. I think there's a lot more in there. There's thousands of laws to look at. But I also want to look at, and something I did, I wasn't able to get into it today, but I wanted to look at how the grants worked and how grants worked. As far as what was this grant, because the Court of Private Land Claims said that these two grants were grazing permits and that they were revoked when the United States took control of New Mexico in 1846 and then 1848 when the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo was signed and the war ended. So that's how they made the decision. And so I went into, and one of the things that they said that these grants were simply a license for the Pueblos to go and graze their cattle. But I found in other grants that Tomas Velas Gachupin, if he wanted to use the word license, he used the word license. If he wanted to say permit, he said permit. And he said in those grants that I'm gonna give you a license to settle this area right here. And if you look like you're doing a good job when I come back next year or whatever the time frame was, I'm gonna put you in possession. And that was one thing that I got interested in this Ojo del Espíritu Santo grant, is because those three pueblos were put into possession. They were put in possession of the land, and that was very important. That was the way that title was transferred. And I noticed that in all of the other valid grants, the same thing happened. The pueblos or the settlers, whoever received the grant, was put in, there was an act of possession. They tore up grass, threw rocks, and shouted, "Long live the king," three times. And that was how title was transferred. So they did that in these two grants, in the Ojo del Espíritu Santo grant. So that, there's a big difference between that and a license, because there was, if he wanted to give him a license, he would have said, he would have used the word. So that's another thing. But to go deeper into it and find out more examples, that's another thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Did all those three pueblos come under the Espíritu Santo grant?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I guess I didn't go over that as much as I should have. But yeah, the Ojo del Espíritu Santo grant was to the three pueblos, Azia, Santa Ana, and Jemez. And so all three of them took possession of that grant land together, jointly. And the Cochiti Pueblo was just to the Cochiti Pueblo. And I mentioned another grant that was confirmed, and that was the Santo Domingo and San Felipe grant, and that was also a pasturing grant. So the Court of Private Land Claims, you know, was at one in one case was saying pasture grants are always licenses, but then in this case over here they were saying confirm it. The pasture grant is a fee simple title. So there was a lot of, you know, there was, you know. The court decided one way, but one thing that came into that case was there was a third party, and I think that's what really stopped the original Ojo del Espíritu Santo grant from being confirmed. A third party came in, and their lawyer was Thomas B. Catron, and he threw him and Matthew Reynolds threw everything out there. They denied that the Pueblos existed. They said the grant was a forgery. It was never in the... One of his arguments that the court somewhat bought was that he said that the testimonial was never, the actual documents were never cataloged in the archives. They were never indexed in the archives. But a testimonial wouldn't be indexed in the archive, because a testimonial is what the grantee received. So the grantee would have the testimonial, and the governor of Zia had this document. In 1873, he submitted this document to the the Surveyor General. So that was one argument that they made. And they also said that because there was overlapping grants, that this grant must have been revoked, and it must have been a license. So that was kind of, the license theory was the way to get around the third-party claim. They could confirm the third party and reject this one by saying it was a license.
Who ended up with that claim?
Katrin did for a while, and the third party got some of it. But then through the Indian Claims Commission, the three pueblos, Zia, Jemez, and Santa Ana, received a portion of it, not the whole thing. It, depending on how you read the boundary calls, it's about 500,000 acres, or it could be as little as 200,000 acres. But it was originally, the Surveyor General wanted to confirm it and surveyed it. And when he surveyed it, it was 380,000 acres. But now the three pueblos have some of it. And in fact, the actual Ojo, which is the spring of the Holy Spirit, is in Jemez. It's in their reservation.
So I guess my question follows. Are there any more so practical implications of your findings?
Well, I think one thing when I was doing this research is that this can kind of serve as a model. Like, if you can find out as much as you can about a grant, you can specifically, as unequivocally as possible, date it to a certain period, then you can make a much stronger case that this grant, then you can move on and say, well, this is how this grant should have worked. And this grant gave fee simple title to the pueblos. It was not a grazing permit. So as far as the three pueblos of Zia, Jemez, and Santa Ana, there may not be much, you know, they could probably say, look, we should get the full amount of acreage. But there could be something with the Cochiti Pueblo. I've been trying to find out what exactly happened, and as of now I haven't found that this was ever, that they ever adjudicated it again. They may have just given up after the Court of Private Land Claims denied the claim. They may have just given up. I actually went there to look to see if they knew anything about the actual document, because like I said, we have the transcription. But I would like to see the testimonial.
And I was going to ask if you've been sharing your findings with the
fellows. I told one of the students from the class ahead of me he's now the judge at Zia Pueblo, and I've told him about it. And I think I'd like to get a little bit further in the research, and then maybe if I can. Once I get further along, you know, maybe talk to the Cochiti Pueblo.
Did you have to go to Mexico, in fact, to dig out some of these documents?
Most of this, I didn't. Most of the work was done in the archives in Santa Fe, mm-hmm. And then some of it was done here, and some of it was done at the law library. Like, some of the briefs I looked at in the law library, and the Indian Claims Commission series is in the law library. And then here I looked at microfilm, and then we had some other works, like some of the other historical works printed. But most of the actual physical documents, I did that in Santa Fe. And in fact, I looked at other ones because I had thought that the watermark that was going to be the easiest to match would have been the bull, because it was the easiest to see. And it turned out there was just a different, you know, the more I looked, the more variations I found. But they were all from the 1770s and the 1780s, and then a few from the 1790s. So even so, they're all from the same period. So I mean, there's no doubt that that document is a colonial document from the 1770s, 1780s, maybe as late as the 1790s, but I'm pretty certain the mid-1780s. No, in fact, I think most of the paper was Italian. These names like Cortino, Notaro, Costa, that might have been. Well, in fact, the catalog that I looked at from the archives in Mexico was pretty certain that everything that came to the New World, New Spain, came from either Genoa, Barcelona. Is it Barcelona? Yeah. It was either Catalonian or Italian, or, you know, Genoa. And, of course, the connection with Genoa is Genoa and Seville had been, you know, the two cities had traded in the Middle Ages, you know, for centuries. And so a lot of paper came from there, but it came in small quantities. That's why the Ojo del Espíritu Santo has one mark on one paper and a mark from a different paper maker on the other paper, because it was, even the supplies that the viceroys got were relatively small. But it did all either come from, they say that if it had a design, a religious design, it probably came from Spain. If it had an animal or a floral design, it probably came from Genoa. They just said that the Italians were more interested in artistic designs and the Spaniards were more interested in religious emblems. So, but that's what I found. But the paper and the Cruzate grants, I'm not sure about. I'm not sure exactly where that came from. And when I looked at those actual documents, you could see that the paper was, the texture was a little bit different. But the paper varies. I mean, I measured every document that I got a chance to examine. I measured them, you know, and there are a lot of different measurements. And I don't know if you remember from the images that there's also the vertical lines, and the vertical lines are what they call chain lines. So I measured those because right away you could, most of them were 15/16ths of an inch, but some of them were different increments. And so right away I could say that it's not the same screen, because a screen would make a distinct mark on the paper. I did do a search to try and find as many catalogs as I could, and actually the very first bull that I showed is out of a book here in Zimmerman that was focused on English and French and Flemish watermarks, but then had a little appendix on Italian watermarks, and that's where I found that one. But you know who studies watermarks is people studying musicology, because they use the, you know, William, you could say more about that. They use that to, is that mainly for the purpose of dating or to try and find, to determine the location of where the...
Well, the biggest example, or the most famous example, is the Beethoven sketchbooks. Beethoven kept extensive musical sketches of his works over periods of years, and he also had a group of conversation books. When he was deaf, you know, he just wrote out conversations with the people he was talking to. Well, those books were taken apart, given, spread all over Europe, and now, if you want to put together a Beethoven sketchbook, you can look at the watermarks on the paper and try to collate the leaves back together. And that has been a major effort over the past 20 or 30 years.
So there's another use. Did you have a question?
Were you doing the Cruzate fraud papers? Did they know who worked on those? How they came about?
The main study on that is by a former UNM student who did her dissertation on them. Her name is Sandra Matthews Lamb. And as far as I know, no one's discovered who created them, but there is a court case from the 1850s, De La O versus Acoma. And it's pretty much believed that the people involved in that had created them and were in the process of selling one to the Acoma Pueblo. And the Pueblo said, "We're not going to buy that. It belongs to us." And so they tried to sue the Pueblo for breach of contract. And it went to court, and the judge was just furious at them for trying to sell a grant to them, but they didn't realize at the time that that was a spurious grant. And so, as far as I know, no one's discovered who actually created them.
You said they must have been written somewhere, what, like 1830s or something?
Right. The theory is that they were created right after the United States took control of New Mexico. The United States got here in 1846, and then the war ended in 1848. So right after that, the theory is that the Pueblos were told that they would need a paper title. And so for the people who created them wrote them up and sold them to the Pueblos for hundreds of dollars. In the court case, they were trying to sell the grant to the Acoma Pueblo for something like $600. So that's why they think that it was made when the Surveyor General started asking for paper title. They think that that's when someone said, let's make up some fakes and let's forge some documents and we'll sell them. Well, yeah, that's part of what I'm saying is that the Cruzate grants are one group of documents that they're spurious. But the title wasn't necessarily under Spanish law. A Pueblo village was entitled to the land where it existed, whether it had a paper document or not. Just under the laws of the Recopilación said that they were entitled to the land that they possess. So that's one theory is why no one's really gone and studied the Cruzate grants in details, because it doesn't really affect. Even if they are forgeries, it doesn't affect the title of those Pueblo villages.
But what standing does a valid land grant from the 18th century Spanish crown have before a 21st century United States court?
Doesn't have any now. The only thing that they could do is go to Congress and ask Congress to investigate and ask Congress to basically make some sort of reparation.
A political solution.
Yeah, a political solution, because it's been adjudicated. So
recently, though, the Sandia Pueblo received acknowledgement of their claim to the top of the mountain based upon a 17th century document.
Right.
So that they're still useful in deciding.
Because the dispute was over the boundary, right. In that sense, yes. But if it's already been, like in the case of the Ojo del Espíritu Santo grant, once the United States Supreme Court said, not confirmed, we affirm the lower decision, Congress had to make a completely new court called the Indian Claims Commission and rehear them again. So, but a boundary dispute would be a little bit different, because that could go back and say, no, this is, we just discovered that we both had it wrong, and now the town of Bernalillo's in, or, some other, something like that. Where a new boundary dispute arises, that would be a little bit different.